Here's a really special deal on a great product from our friends over at Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. You can now receive a $39 bottle of artisanal fresh pressed oil free if you just pay $1 to help cover shipping. And there's nothing else you must buy now or ever. It's a wonderful opportunity because with olive oil, my number one rule is the fresher, the better. That's because the olive is a fruit, and olive oil is actually a fruit juice. Like any other fruit juice, extra virgin olive oil is at its glorious peak of freshness, flavor, and nutritional potency when fresh squeezed. And that's what's missing with so many supermarket olive oils. After sitting on the shelf for months or even years, they've lost their freshness and can't compare with just pressed EVU shipped direct from the new harvest. Here at Milk Street, we really like these oils' vibrant, grassy flavors, as well as the intoxicating aroma, just like a garden in a bottle. Prove it yourself with no obligation to buy anything ever. For your free $39 bottle direct from an award-winning artisanal farm, go to getfresh177.com. That's getfresh177.com. One last time, getfresh177.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi, this is Christopher Kimball. Thanks for downloading this week's podcast. You can go to our website, 177milkstreet.com, for our recipes, culinary ideas from around the world, or our latest cookbooks. Now, here's this week's show. This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Today, it's my interview with Brianna Holt. She's the pastry chef at Tandem Bakery, which operates out of an old body shop in Portland, Maine. We chat about how to mix and match flavors in order to transform your baking.
I think I like getting out of what seems like a strict rule. Like, if I know that a recipe calls for milk, I think to myself, could it be better with buttermilk? Or, you know, if I replace brown butter, could that nutty flavor complement the other ingredients, stuff like that.
Also coming up, Dan Pashman struggles to find a reliable way to cook eggplant, and we learn how to make chicken vindaloo. But first, it's my interview with Stephen Hayman on his biography of Lewis Bromfield, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist who was once America's most famous farmer. Hayman's book is called The Planter of Modern Life. Stephen, welcome to Milk Street.
Thank you for having me.
You just wrote a book about a guy I should have heard of, Lewis Bromfield, and never did. He was a famous literary figure and also a famous figure in the world of organic farming. Maybe we could start about his beginnings. In World War I, he was in World War I. It seemed like that was a turning point for the century, but also for him.
That's right. I mean, he was one of many future novelist to serve as a volunteer ambulance driver in World War I. But Bromfield was immediately captivated by France, by the culture, and by the agriculture. Even in the midst of the war, in the midst of the fighting, he was kind of looking at the sweet peas growing close to the front, and how the peach trees were grown against old walls.
So he ends up in this idyllic, 1920s, 30s France, Hemingway, Edith Wharton, Gertrude Stein. He has a place outside of Paris. Just tell us about that.
Right. So like a lot of writers in the 20s, he moves to Paris to take advantage of the advantageous economics. And there was obviously a lot of interesting cultural things happening there at the moment. But instead of renting a garret on the Left Bank, Bromfield very quickly moves from Paris to the countryside, to this suburb called Senlis, where he begins work on a very elaborate garden. And the garden becomes a kind of salon and hotspot where Bromfield connects with lots of different personalities, including his two closest friends, Gertrude Stein and Edith Wharton. And these writers were obviously kind of diametrically opposed in style, but they were both drawn to Bromfield because of his passion and knowledge about gardening.
Well, he's a true Renaissance man. Someone described him in his garden as having the shirt of a gangster, the trousers of a student, the slippers of a peanut salesman. So yeah. Here's a guy who talks about golden bantam corn, how to cook a hamburger, and then Bombay Palace intrigue. So he was fully versed from literature, gossip, celebrity, cooking, gardening.
It's true. And I mean, I think that because of all of those divergent things, a lot of people in his own time didn't really know what to make of him. And I think that that partially accounts for why he was forgotten ultimately.
He was a very famous novelist whom I've never heard of, but he sold a lot of books. Could you just talk about that part of his career briefly?
Yeah, so he rose to fame in the 1920s as a novelist, and his third novel, Early Autumn, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1927. And in that decade, he was better known and certainly more highly regarded by the literary establishment than either Hemingway or Fitzgerald. At the time, his novels became a little bit more commercial. Many of them were made into Hollywood films, including The Rains Came, one of his most famous novels, which was made into a film in 1939. And it was with the money that he earned from that film that he was able to finance this amazing farm in Ohio called Malabar.
Well, it's interesting because you describe his farm, Malabar, as a medieval fortress manor of France. So he was an isolationist in some ways by returning to Ohio and buying this farm. On the other hand, he was very much out and about in society and trying to, you know, propagate his views about not just literary things, but also about how to farm.
Absolutely, yeah. Bromfield was a consummate romantic, but when he started farming in a major way, he also had to balance out that romanticism with some serious pragmatism.
So let's just talk about farming practices in the States up until that time. He was not happy with the state of American farming, right?
Absolutely. He had grown up kind of with one foot on his grandfather's farm and loved everything about farming. Then in the 1930s, while he's sitting in his lush garden having tea with Edith Wharton, he's reading accounts of the Dust Bowl. He's reading about farmers being dispossessed of their land by the millions. And he learns about chemicals entering agriculture in a big way, and a lot of extremely harmful practices. And it affected him as well. When he bought Malabar, he found the farm in a kind of romantic snow-covered valley in the winter of 1938. And then when the snow melted, he realized that all of the sandy, loose, alluvial topsoil had basically been washed off the hills, and there were gullies dug so deep that you could lose a horse inside them. And so basically, he transforms his own land, and in that process kind of transforms himself and becomes an evangelist for what he calls the new agriculture.
What has come out of Malabar? I mean, one of the things he talked about was his dairy herd had very few incidents of disease because of the quality of the feed. Was anything learned by American agriculture from Malabar that's not in use today?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you can't point to one specific technique and say Bromfield invented this. But I think that he started a conversation that's really still going on today. And the conversation's about how we can responsibly live off the land and feed ourselves. Plenty of other people wrote about agriculture before him. But in Bromfield's work and in the work of his allies from the 30s and 40s, we see for the first time the emergence of an environmental consciousness that is recognizably modern. You know, he was really the first celebrity, the first figure of national prominence to, on the one hand, celebrate food, and on the other hand, problematize it, you know, connect it to the environment, to health, to politics, and even to art.
So I read in your book that Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall got married at the farm in the 1940s, and Bromfield was actually the best man.
Yes, and that was a big moment for Malabar because it kind of established the farm's national reputation. It was a huge celebrity wedding, and people were confused. Again, why are these two Hollywood stars getting married in rural Ohio? But Bromfield had that kind of charisma and those connections, and so he could make his farm a destination, even though it was in the middle of nowhere.
Here's a guy who, you know, Humphrey Bogart gets married to Lauren Bacall on his farm. He's a literary figure. He's more famous than Hemingway. And, you know, I'm reasonably well-read. I'd never heard of him. I never heard of Malabar, and even though I'm fascinated by this topic. How does history drop people like this? They sort of become obscure. Is there a rhyme and reason to that?
I think it's a great question, and it's almost impossible to answer. My best theory is that in Bromfield's time, no one really understood how the different pieces of his life fit together. You know, the literary critics, they dismissed his farm as the plaything of a dilettante. Ordinary dirt farmers were suspicious of his Hollywood friends and high society connections. And then the environmentalists were turned off by his unpredictable politics. So he was a confusing figure, and he just kind of soared like a comet through the first half of the 20th century and then vanished.
If he were alive today, do you think he would be someone who would be helpful in finding the way forward to the next act, whatever that might be?
I do think so. And I also think that the modernity of what he's doing is kind of central to his project. You know, if he were alive today, would probably have several million followers on Twitter and a podcast, and he'd be trying to really move the needle. He was a pragmatist and somebody who was interested in connecting with lots of people. And I think that I wish we had someone like that today arguing for a better way of structuring our agricultural system.
Stephen, it's been a real pleasure having you on Mill Street with the story of Lewis Bromfield. Thanks.
Thanks so much. It was great to be here.
That was Stephen Hayman. His book is The Planter of Modern Life, Lewis Bromfield and the Seeds of a Food Revolution. Right now, my co-host Sarah Moult and I will be answering your cooking questions. Sarah is the author of Home Cooking 101, also star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals on public television. Hi, Sarah.
Hello, Chris.
Do you want to take the first call?
Yes, I do. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Barbara in Cypress, Texas.
Hi, Barbara from Cypress, Texas. What can we help you with today?
My question is about recipes that call for fresh mint.
Okay.
My mints have a base of spearmint oil or peppermint oil, except for my red-stemmed apple mint, which is the only mint that has both spearmint and peppermint oil. So I'm wondering, when a recipe calls for mint, what am I using?
I think the short answer is spearmint.
Yes, I would say so.
Peppermint is stronger.
Yeah, I think if you want a more assertive mint with a little bit of a bite, then you go for peppermint. If you want a, you know, a more mild mint, you go with spearmint. And I have not had a lot of experience with apple mint. That's interesting that it's got both of the oils from the two different kinds. But I would say that would be somewhere in between.
Yeah, I think in general, you just want a mild mint for cooking.
Yeah.
You don't want anything too assertive because it'll just take over the dish.
Right.
Some of the mints are self-explanatory. My chocolate mint smells like dessert.
Yes.
The mojito mint, you know, clearly that's going to be Cuban. But some of the other varieties. You know.
So wait. There's a mojito mint?
I've never heard of that.
No, come on.
I think you made that up.
No, it's a large-leafed mint with a beautiful green color that's very textured. I've got probably 12 varieties of mint.
I got to back you up a second. You have like a dozen kinds of mint growing in your garden?
Yes, I do. And when a recipe calls for mint, I wind up standing in my garden just flummoxed, not knowing which one to use because they never tell me spearmint or peppermint. If I know spearmint or peppermint, then I can fine-tune from there.
Well, I knew a woman once who started with one cat and ended up with a dozen. I mean, is this like you started with someone gave you a spearmint plant and just sort of got out of control?
I'm a gardener who's looking for recipes to make a case for why I need a dozen mints or half a dozen kinds of oregano or 10 kinds of basil.
Oh, I see. So this isn't just mint. You're just an herb garden.
Nut.
Exactly.
Okay, well, I have to ask you a question then. Since you're an herb garden gal, what is your all-time favorite unusual herb?
Good question.
My favorite unusual one would be a barbecue rosemary because it grows big, straight, firm canes. And then I can put lamb on those. I use my rosemary as an actual skewer for lamb kebabs.
For kebabs.
Wow.
Yes.
Good for you.
Well, Barbara, thank you for sharing all that. You know, you could start a little blog of your own.
I would love to. In my meals, I'll start out in the garden with a pair of scissors.
I love that.
That's a good
one. And then I go find something to do with it.
I think we should name the barbecue rosemary Barbara Q. Rosemary.
I like that.
There you go.
Okay.
Name will live on. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
This is Milk Street Radio. If you have a cooking question, give us a ring, 855-426-9843. One more time, 855-426-9843, or email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Laura.
Hi, Laura. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from New Jersey. So I have a question on popovers. I tried to make them a couple of months ago. They're the probably simplest thing to make, flour, milk, egg. And I made them fine and they tasted well, but they didn't hold their shape. So I'm wondering, what is the science behind getting them to like not flatten once you take them out of the oven?
I have a few questions, popover questions. Did you let the batter sit for at least half an hour before you baked it?
No, I did not, actually.
Let it sit for 30 minutes. Did you preheat the popover pan in the oven?
I did not preheat the popover pan oven, actually.
I should stop now. Yeah, let the batter sit for 30 minutes, preheat your pan, and then once you took them out of the oven, did you take them out of the popover pan right away and then pierce the bottom with a sharp paring knife?
No.
I got 3 out of 3. I went for it.
Wow.
I risked everything.
Okay.
Yeah. Let the batter sit, preheat the pan, and when they come out, don't let them sit in the pan. Take them out on a cooling rack and then just punch a little hole in the bottom for the steam to escape. There's one last thing you could try. Slightly overcooking them. You have to be careful because I don't like popovers that are too crispy. I like that really soft, you know, moist interior.
Mm-hmm.
Just give it 2 or 3 extra minutes, and that'll help set them better so they're less likely to collapse.
All right. Now,
I've run out of everything I know about popovers, and now it's Sarah's turn.
One of the things I wanted to ask you that's very important, do you have popover tins, or did you try to do it in muffin tins?
I did. I used muffin tins, and that was another thing I was going to ask you. Did I use a wrong tin?
I think that the popover tins are better because they're taller, so you have a chance to develop a taller popover, which will have more structure.
Preheat the tins?
Well, yes.
Yes, preheat the tins.
Okay. I'm going to agree with Chris, even though I've made them without preheating the tins.
And,
but yes.
And what about piercing the bottom with a paring knife?
I don't think you have to.
Okay.
I've never pierced the bottom, you know, and they've stayed up pretty well. But I will say this, popovers like soufflés are powered by the air and eggs, and it's what goes up must come down, and there's no way around it.
Unless you bake it just a little longer.
Which I agree with Chris about. But, you know, part of the joy of it is rushing it from the oven and eating it, you know, while it's still hot. And I agree with Chris that you want that sort of gooey, ooey, gooey stuff in the middle.
And use real popover pans, which are 6 cups in a set.
Right. And I think that will make a huge difference.
Laura, give that a shot if you can remember anything we said, because I'm confused.
Oh, no, I was taking notes.
Oh, good.
So thank you so much.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Up next, we'll hear from pastry chef Brianna Holt. That and more after the break.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You know, I like classic clothing that never goes out of style, and that's why I suggest you check out Quince, an online clothing store that focuses on timeless essentials at great prices. I recently bought a Mongolian cashmere sweater for under $100. It's a great sweater and a great deal. Now that warm weather is upon us, Quince has all the seasonal must-haves, like 100% European linen shirts from $30, performance polos, and versatile flow-knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands by partnering directly with top factories. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. Upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/milkstreet for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/milkstreet. to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/milkstreet. You know, Wonderful pistachios have become my go-to snack. Now, I could list all the health benefits. They're a good source of protein, fiber, and unsaturated fats. But for me, flavor comes first, and that's why it's pistachios, not peanuts, in our household. Wonderful pistachios come in a variety of flavors and sizes, including sea salt and vinegar, chili roasted, and smoked barbecue. Check out WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more. That's WonderfulPistachios.com. This is Milk Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Right now, it's my interview with Brianna Holt. Born and raised in Martha's Vineyard, today Holt is the pastry chef at Portland, Maine's Tandem Coffee and Bakery. Brianna, welcome to Milk Street.
Thank you so much.
Maybe we should start with a description of where you work, because it's an old gas station turned into a coffee shop, a pastry destination. So what does it look like, and what is it like working in a gas station?
It's really beautiful. It's like a big white building. It's got that kind of awning out front. Like, it was never actually a gas station. It was actually a body shop. They worked on, you know, brakes and shocks and cars. They would lift them up inside, that kind of thing. So it has that really beautiful 60s shape to it. You know, it's kind of wide and lots of front window, big windows in the front, and a big awning out front into the parking lot. So there's a lot of room to hang out there. The light streams in, and it's basically a big open space that we built a kitchen in.
So you have this interesting view of baking. This is a quote from you. You're talking about a tray of biscuits. You say, "They," referring to the biscuits, "do the thing that I've asked them to do." So already they're alive, the little people, with my hands. They pop up in the right way. The top looks right. They lean over just a little. That is the moment that keeps me doing it. So you have this personification of baking goods as friends or people you like to spend time with. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's like anything you do with someone else, kind of like a transaction of sorts. You know, I'm trying to like coax something out of the ingredients or the combination of ingredients in the oven or something like that. I think, especially with biscuits, it's kind of easy to talk about that idea because every single little thing you do with your hands and your fingers results in that that top or that lean or the flake, you know? So yeah, that's kind of how I think of it.
I think I read somewhere that you have PTSD when it comes to muffins because you've made thousands of them. Is that true? Or have you gone to some kind of recovery clinic and are back into muffins again?
Man, it's tough. I would say I'm very, very slowly, gingerly, tenderly coming back around to the muffin. But yeah, when I was probably like 24, I went back to Martha's Vineyard for a short time. I was in love with this guy, this musician that lived there. And I thought, if I leave my sort of post-college, what's coming next kind of life, and I go back to Martha's Vineyard, we're going to fall in love and get married and live together forever. And so I went back and I worked at this pretty crappy little sandwich shop. And I made muffins at like 5 a.m. every morning. So many. I mean, I don't even know how to talk about it. And we would make the mixture in like huge vats and then store them in Home Depot buckets, like 5-gallon Home Depot buckets in this dirty walk-in. And the place was owned by this crazy guy who was never really there. He just kind of left it up to the teenagers and the 20-year-olds, you know, and we would come in hungover and it'd be like 5 a.m. and I'd be scooping like really crappy muffins out of these like 5-gallon buckets. But we had to make them, you know, that was his recipe, the muffin mixture. And then you added blueberries or like bananas and walnuts or whatever. And they were huge, you know, they were like the size of like a softball. And we sold so many, I can't even begin to tell you. And I never liked them. I thought they could be better, but it wasn't my job to change it. And I just saw so many muffins, it became this like muffin nightmare. So
let's talk about your interesting way of combining ingredients. I remember last summer you did a chocolate cake with juniper in it, or pineapple and married with rosemary, or apple with feta.
Yeah.
So you have this herbal savory mix with something fruity or sweet. You just end up doing this because it's 2 a.m. and you just chance upon it, or you spend months thinking about these combinations and scientifically come up with them?
Both. I think all of the above. Sometimes it just, I mean, it sounds silly and cliche, but sometimes it just pops into my head. I think that probably happens with a lot of people out there. The more that I eat and the more that I see food around in the world, the more things there are kind of ping-ponging around in my brain. And so if I'm thinking about making something, you know, it's almost like just reaching into like a bucket of fish or something. You know, there's so much that I like and so much that I've seen and I'm excited about that sometimes something will just jump out to me. Or I kind of want to make something that feels right for the season or something like that. The chocolate juniper cake was sort of like a fall and winter time. That the inception of that cake was like deep winter, thinking about like richness and cold weather and sort of like, this is going to sound silly, but like rich, beautiful kind of medieval feasts, you know, and like what might be on the table and something kind of mellow but strong flavored. It's also really beautiful. Juniper berry is gorgeous. It's not really a berry. It's almost more like a pine cone. What we do at the bakery is roast them and they start to release their oils and they get this crazy fragrant smell. It fills the kitchen. We try to do it when it's not busy because it is almost a weird, crazy smell and people aren't necessarily sure if they like it. But then you grind it up and it, and we make ground toasted juniper and it's really beautiful smell. It's deep and woodsy, but also floral. And it just seems to pair really nicely with chocolate. And it's really good. It's almost like you bite into it and you're not exactly sure what it is.
Here's my favorite Brianna Holt quote. Have you ever chugged a Schlitz while prancing around in your house making pie? Try it. Could you just describe that image and whether you actually do that or not?
I do that, to be totally honest. And I would challenge anyone to tell me that they don't. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's why I got into this business. I just love doing it and being in my kitchen and fussing with ingredients and prepping ingredients and putting things together. That's really fun for me. And, you know, I love listening to music really loud. I love drinking like cold, crisp, like beer flavored beer. And yeah, that's how I feel about baking at home. I just, it's just like total pleasure for me.
You have some tricks or things you use in baking. I know you put ricotta into batters a lot. You love brown butter with a cream cheese frosting or in a maple pie. What are some of the things you rely on, you've learned that make you such a good baker?
I think I like getting out of what seems like a strict rule. Like if I know that a recipe calls for milk, I think to myself, could it be better with buttermilk? Could it be made more flavorful or have a better texture with the acidity that buttermilk would bring? Or would it have a richness and a density that ricotta could help with? Or, you know, if I replace brown butter in a recipe that I'm thinking of, could that nutty flavor complement the other ingredients? Stuff like that. Sometimes there's no need to go deeper and further, but I think I always try to think about it.
The question I get most from people is, how do I know when it's done when it comes to baking?
Yeah.
So do you have some advice for us? Because every cookbook, you know, put a toothpick in it, press it down. Does it come away from the edges if you're talking about a cake?
Yeah.
Use an instant read thermometer, measure the temperature. Mm-hmm. Lots of pies and cheesecakes should be undercooked when you take them out so it cooks on the counter. Could you just give us your tips for that?
Yeah, I think all those things you just said are definitely real and true. I do think overall, and this is a broad statement, but I do think overall there's a tendency to overbake things in general. I know the toothpick trick is tried and true and our grandmothers said it, but ultimately I think a toothpick shouldn't come out clean from a cake. I think if the toothpick comes out clean, your cake is overdone. Yeah. I think it should come out a little moist crumbs, you know, and it also depends on the cake or brownies even. I think brownies should basically be like almost raw in the middle and then you take them out. I had a boss when I was younger that would always say cooling is part of cooking and I've never forgotten that. And I think it's really important. I think it's true. I mean, something can come out of the oven and go onto the cooling rack at the bakery and you have customers in line and they're like, there it is, I want it. And you're like, it's not done. You might think it's done, but it's actually not done. It's going to sit there and the heat in the middle is going to escape and things are going to settle. Like with the scones we bake, it's one of the biggest learning curves for new bakers is to learn when the scones are done, because you're going to think for a while that it's still a little bit raw in the middle. But really what's happening is you're going to pull it out and then that middle is going to settle and become the kind of like soft, deliciously cakey part of the scone, whereas the outside is like nice and crisp. So I think it kind of depends on what you're baking, but I think with a grain of salt, all those things that you said, those tried and true things about the cake pulling away from the pan and the poker in the middle of the cake can be guidelines, but I don't think that they're strict. You know, I think a cake should feel soft and tender and kind of bouncy when you poke at it with your fingers. I do a lot of touching of things in the oven.
So let's take cheesecake because, you know, everyone runs around being sleepless and angry about cracking cheesecakes, you know. which probably means they overbake them. So how do you know when a cheesecake's ready to come out?
Man, well, when I bake a cheesecake at home, it usually takes kind of a long time, and I always bake it. I know there are other methods, but I usually bake it in a water bath. And similar to a custard pie, I try to look for the perfect jiggle, which to me should be like a soft, like slightly chubby tummy or like a fake boob or something. Do you know what I mean? Like there should be this like jiggle, not like a waterbed where it's super wavy, but a little jiggle in the middle a kind of a little scent, like around the middle zone, that's less jiggly and the edges more more set. And that's what I think of with a cheesecake.
That's the, yeah. Okay, I'm speechless now. Sandwiches. You're in love with sandwiches.
Love them
because you know it's just a major improvisational art. Could you give us some advice about those of us who are a little sandwich challenged? could you liberate us and give us some new ideas?
Yeah, my number one rule is that there are no rules about sandwiches. I think it's an opportunity to put a bunch of stuff that you like the way it tastes and put it together. And I'm a big fan of texture, so I have to have, there almost always needs to be something like crunchy in the sandwich. I mean, it depends on what it is.
Why don't you just give us a couple of examples?
Well, I often put kimchi in my sandwiches. It's like really crunchy and fresh and kind of spicy. And so I think of it as like that like crunchy, almost like lettuce, crunchy, fresh component. I've been making a lot of weird sandwiches during this strange quarantine lockdown time. This kind of gentle Italian sandwich vibe. I get a lot of like Genoa or hot capicola or mortadella and cheese, kimchi, mayonnaise, tons of mayonnaise.
And you're obsessed with mayonnaise, right?
I love it so much. I have a mayonnaise tattoo.
Wait a minute.
I make mayonnaise. Mayonnaise.
Wait, what's a mayonnaise tattoo?
It just says more mayo, which is kind of like my life philosophy.
Brianna, it's been just a great pleasure. Been a lot of fun having you on Milk Street.
Thank you so much. I love chatting with you, Chris.
That was Brianna Holt, pastry chef at Portland, Maine's Tandem Coffee and Bakery. Much has been written about Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000-hour rule. You know, it takes practice to become a genius. Well, practice is essential, but some people are simply born with a great gift. Mozart composed his first song at age 5. Yasha Heifetz took up the violin at age 3. And Sor Juana Inez de la Cruz mastered Latin before age 10. So in the kitchen, anyone can become a good, even a great cook, but few among us have an outsized talent for transforming ingredients into something really extraordinary. Combining chocolate and juniper, like Brianna Holt does, is not taught at cooking school. I think it's bred in the bone. It's time to chat with Raina Javeri about this week's recipe, chicken vindaloo. Raina, how are you?
Hi, Chris. I'm well.
Chicken vindaloo, something you know a lot about, something I know a little about. Where is it from and what's the recipe?
So, Chris, chicken vindaloo is actually a signature dish coming out of the small state of Goa in southwestern India. Now, Goa was a Portuguese colony until as recently as 1968. So a lot of the Portuguese influences are in the cuisine, especially in this dish. Now, what I love about this dish is that it's a three-way combination, kind of a power punch of sweet, heat, and sour. There's a little sugar, some spiciness from dried chilies, and the tang from the two ingredients that give it its name, vind and aloo, vinegar and garlic.
I didn't know that. Every time we work together, I learn something. So obviously the chilies are a critical ingredient. Is there just one type they use, or it depends where you are in India when you make this dish?
So it kind of varies, Chris. Kashmiri chilies are a fundamental part of this dish. They give it a lot of the color, the richness and thickness and brightness and fruitiness. But there are also local chilies that are searingly hot that are used. Now, neither Kashmiri chilies nor those local Goan chilies are available easily here. So what we've done is found a substitute. And what we do here is use a mixture of sweet paprika and cayenne. And that works pretty well.
Is this just a basic braise? I mean, how do you make the dish? A skillet dish or what?
So this is actually a great one-pot dish. It gets all cooked in a Dutch oven. And what I love about this dish is that the marinade becomes the sauce. So the chicken gets marinated for 10 to 15 minutes in a marinade that we make in the blender, very easy. And then all of that gets put straight into the Dutch oven. And the rest of it is almost hands-off. There's very little to do. The chicken may stick at the beginning to the bottom, and you get some really nice flavors developing because of that. And the sauce we see goes from a bright red to a deep brown, again, developing a lot of flavor as it cooks. But you cover it, walk away, about 45 minutes total, and this dish is done.
Raina, thank you. Chicken Vindaloo, sweet, sour, and spicy. One pot under an hour. You fulfilled all my dreams. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. You can get this recipe for Chicken Vindaloo at milkstreetradio.com.
This is Milk Street Radio. Coming up, Dan Pashman admits he is eggplant phobic. We'll be right back. You know, I grew up with Vermont farmers who made do with tools they had on hand. A hammer, pliers, and baling twine, of course, for most jobs. When I became a cook, however, I found that having just the right knife or maybe the perfect carbon steel skillet made all the difference. And the right tool also added pleasure to my cooking. I truly enjoyed my time prepping as well as cooking food. And that also goes for a car. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. And that includes available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Christopher Kimball. You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Right now, Sarah Moulton and I will be answering a few more of your cooking questions.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, my name is Lori.
Hi, Lori. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, we'll see if we can answer your question. That always...
And then we'll feel
that
good.
That cheers me right up.
Then we'll be very good.
Okay. So when I was growing up in the early 60s, my grandmother and mother used to take me regularly to a luncheonette. I always ordered waffles, and they had a tangy, almost sharp taste, like a bite to them. And I have been trying to reproduce that taste for most of my adult life, and I cannot do it.
I mean, the obvious question, but I know you've already gone there, is buttermilk. You've tried buttermilk?
I've tried buttermilk. I've tried yeasted waffles. I've tried, someone recommended malt,
right,
which I tried. But it had almost a bite to it that I cannot recreate.
There's one thing you haven't mentioned, which is the world's most difficult waffle recipe, which is sourdough. Now, sourdough would have that tang. I don't think a place like that would bother making sourdough waffles. I think that's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Maybe they made waffles out of the milk that had soured. Like sour milk was a typical recipe, right, in a lot of baking back in the 19th century. Maybe they just used soured milk. That's actually could be.
Yeah.
But the buttermilk is what I would think would be the obvious choice.
I would too.
And that didn't do it, huh?
Well, again, I'm using commercial buttermilk. So maybe they made their own buttermilk.
I don't know. I would think in the early 60s, buttermilk was quite different than it is now. That makes the most sense to me. And the kind of buttermilk they were using was tangier than what we have today.
That's possible.
That would be my best guess. Because I think the sourdough thing is just not reasonable.
I guess I can look at recipes for making your own buttermilk.
What about adding some sour cream?
Yeah. Well, that's the other possibilities. Well, there you go. That's an excellent buttermilk and sour cream.
Yeah.
That's the other possibility.
Yeah. I think I came across a Betty Crocker recipe with sour cream.
Yeah, well, I think that's an excellent suggestion.
Yeah.
Because that would be tangy.
Yeah.
And that's an easy thing to do.
Yeah, I would do that.
It'd be delicious, even if it wasn't the same. I mean, the right one.
You want to spend 2 hours churning your own butter just to get some buttermilk to try buttermilk being waffles. I mean, that's a little on the
extreme.
Edge. Yeah. Yeah, sour cream. I think of all the things we've said, sour cream.
Okay. All right. And Lori, let us know how it goes.
Okay, report back, please.
All right.
Okay.
Give that a shot.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye. Bye-bye.
This is Milk Street Radio. If you're stuck in a rut in the kitchen, give us a call, 855-426-9843. That's 855-426-9843. Or email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Alan.
How are you? Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from, well, I'm near Philadelphia right now.
Okay. Can we help you?
I hope so. Lately, I've been making my own cookies, and sometimes I get an idea for flavor that I particularly, want to see in a cookie. And this time, I'm just not getting there. What I want is to make a pistachio cookie with the kind of, like a peanut butter cookie, with that much flavor. And I thought this should be easy. Take peanut butter cookie recipe, grind up some pistachios and substitute, and you're done, right? And the flavor just does not come through after baking, and I don't know why. I've tried adding some serious amounts of, pistachio extract to the batter, to the icing applied after the batter, tried adding pistachios themselves to a kind of a bland cooking recipe, and it never happened. Why is the pistachio flavor so...
elusive.
So shy, yeah.
Well, pistachios don't have as much flavor as peanuts. I mean, if you ever had a peanut butter ice cream, it's just packed with flavor. And if you have pistachio ice cream or gelato in Italy, it's green, but it's artificially flavored because pistachios don't have a lot of flavor.
There's a company called Tourangelle, Tourangelle, and they're from France, and they sell toasted nut oils. And one of the ones that I love is toasted pistachio oil.
It's probably fairly expensive proposition for a big batch of pistachio cookies, you think?
No, I don't think so. It's really strong. It's like toasted sesame oil. So a little goes a long way.
That's a good idea.
I love it. Either Chris or Alan, have you had toasted pumpkin seed oil?
Mm-hmm. I have that.
Which is delicious in salads, although very strong. But this is similar in that it's sort of essence of pistachio, and it's...
Another product we just tasted in Milk Street. It was a pistachio cream, and it was sort of like almond butter.
Yeah.
But it was pistachio. It was a very dark green, and I would have eaten the whole jar if
was
they
let pistachio-y?
Me. Oh, yeah. That's another thing
thought.
To look at if you get pistachio cream. But to go back to your initial question, if you toasted or roasted the pistachios first, and then maybe even ground them to make a flour out of it as part of the cookie, that would be... One thing you could do, substitute some of the all-purpose flour with a homemade pistachio flour. But just adding some chopped up pistachios isn't going to do very much.
Try this oil. It would also be delicious in a green salad or, with cheese. It's just wonderful. And it's a great company, Tourangelle.
Okay, great. That sounds great. Well, I only got a few more things to try.
Well, you know what, Alan, please, will you get back to us and let us know how it goes?
Okay, sure.
We always like to know.
And send us a tin of the cookies.
Yeah, that's trying to completely acceptable.
Anyway. Alan, thank you for calling.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Take care.
This is Milk Street Radio. Now it's time for this week's cooking tip from one of our listeners.
I'm Ben. I'm calling from New York, and here's my tip. You don't need jarred tomato sauce, a can of crushed tomatoes, or 30 minutes to make a great pasta sauce. All you need is some blistered cherry tomatoes, sliced garlic, and pasta water. Use a spoon to release the tomato juices, then mix it all together to combine, adding some Parmesan cheese if you like. It takes 5 minutes, and it's the best tomato sauce you'll have.
If you'd like to share your own culinary hack or secret ingredient on Milk Street Radio, please go to 177milkstreet.com/radiotips. Next up, it's the unpredictable Dan Pashman. Dan Pashman, what are you up to these days?
Well, Chris, I come to you this week, hat in hand, to ask you for help.
What kind of hat do you have?
I don't need help with the hat. I'm just saying it's in my hand. It's a proverb, okay?
How can I help, Dan?
Okay, so my issue is this. I got a problem with eggplant, okay? And it's really been upsetting me. I love eggplant when it is good eggplant cooked just right, but I don't seem to be able to do that very often in my own home. I love grilled eggplant. I make this great salad where I take grilled eggplant and grilled red onion and Israeli couscous and mix those all together, and people love it. You know, I just, any kind of good grilled eggplant, or I'll do it on the sheet pan in the oven, but I feel like, you know, I've done the research. I know that you're supposed to pick eggplants that have tight, shiny skin and very firm, and I do that, but then I don't always get to cooking it right away. I don't know if they're just sitting in my fridge for too long, or maybe I'm not. I don't know what I'm doing wrong, Chris. Help me.
Well, I can help you out.
What do I need to do?
Well, get any old eggplant, cut it in half lengthwise, score it, right, with a knife.
Okay.
Oil it, salt it, cut side down on a very hot grill, 2 to 3 minutes till it gets nice and brown. Flip it over on the cool side of a grill and let it cook 25, 30 minutes until it's totally soft. I mean, absolutely cooked through. And then a bunch of oil with some grated garlic in it, maybe sesame seeds or za'atar or some other spice mix. You know, put that on, let that get down into the cracks, and it's phenomenal. I mean, it's thoroughly cooked. It's almost like baba ganoush. It's very soft.
That sounds really good.
You could put, you know, Greek yogurt on it if you wanted, whatever.
I feel like about half the time my eggplant has a very bitter, almost metallic taste. Hmm. What am I doing wrong?
I think if you cook it a really long time with some good olive oil at the end, I think that bitterness goes away. It becomes actually pretty sweet, especially if you get a really good char, you know, really deep browning on the outside of the grilled side.
Here's how I typically do it. I'll slice the eggplant into rounds.
Right.
Pretty thick, you know, like a 3/4 of an inch, let's say, thick to maybe even an inch thick, and put them on the grill for like, you know, 10 minutes on each side. And sometimes they're good and sometimes they're not. And I don't know if I'm picking bad eggplants. I think maybe sometimes I'm just leaving them on the grill too long, but you're saying get a good char on it. They just feel like very fussy vegetables.
Well, the other thing is if you're going to cook them that way, slice them, salt them, put them in a colander for 20 minutes, and then actually press out between paper towels. You can press the slices a little bit. And a lot of people think that gets rid of some of the bitterness in the eggplant, and go ahead and grill it that way. But I think the classic Middle Eastern method of just taking a big, you know, big old eggplant, cutting in half and grilling it till it's really soft, I find it's very sweet. It has no bitterness. I think long cooking really does the job.
All right. That's a good tip. I like that.
You don't sound, wait a minute, Dan, you sound half convinced.
Well, no, I mean, look, I got, you know, Chris, like you, I'm a skeptic until I've tried it. So, I put a lot of stock in your take on these things. So, if you tell me that this is going to work and that I just need to sort of, I think I need a bit more of a low and slow approach, maybe a quick char on the outside. But I think that maybe I've been cooking my eggplants on too high of a heat for too short of a time. And that's why I'm not cooking off the bitterness. I think that's what my problem is.
Yeah, you really have to, and it almost doesn't hold together, you know, as a vegetable at that point. It's just terrific.
Now you're making me hungry for eggplant.
I can't believe I've changed your life.
Can you eat the skin of an eggplant in any situation? Should it be eaten?
Yeah, you can, sure. I mean, it's fully cooked. It's not tough at all.
Right, because when I make that salad with the grilled eggplant and the grilled red onion and the Israeli couscous, even when I get the eggplant cooked just right, a lot of people I find pick out the pieces of charred skin.
Are these family members or just distant relations?
They're friends and acquaintances.
Oh, well. Now I think low and slow. Start grill over hot, low and slow, half an hour or so.
Okay.
And you'll get a soft, sweet, creamy eggplant. It's one of the easiest recipes in the world. It'll change your mind about bitter eggplant.
Okay. Do you share my disdain for eggplant parmesan?
Yes.
Good.
Because the texture, eggplant, unless you really fully cook it, the texture is dubious. But again, slicing, salting, and pressing between paper towels will get a lot of that liquid out and give you a meatier texture if you go the sliced route,
but
which I would do.
I feel like with eggplant parm, either you end up where like the eggplant's sliced so thin that it's kind of invisible, and you're really just like, we all want to believe, oh, it's healthy because it's eggplant, but like, didn't you fry the eggplant and now it's all breaded and like, you know, there's a lot of fat and then it's like the eggplant disappears. You're really just eating like crispy bits with cheese and sauce, which is delicious, but then just like put it in chicken already.
Yeah.
plus, like you say, if you don't drain the water in advance, it gets very wet. It's very sort of soggy.
That's true. But I've solved your eggplant problem and it's simple. The best solution is simplicity, right?
So you're right. I think the things I was doing wrong is that I was overcomplicating things and I was cooking it too high, too fast. And I think this has been a good session. I appreciate your input, and I'm going to go cook some eggplant now.
By the way, I bill by the half-hour increments. So, Dan, you came to me with hat in hand, and you walked away with a whole eggplant, and hopefully you can go back to the kitchen and cook a good one.
That's right. I'll keep an eye out for that invoice, Chris. Thanks.
Okay, take care, Dan. All right. That was Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful Food Podcast. A 2011 study of Japanese children found that the eggplant was, in fact, their most hated vegetable. And I guess that Dan Pashman agrees. First grown in India, eggplant is now known as the king of vegetables. Proponents say that it prevents cancer and cardiovascular disease and is also good for weight loss and brain activity. On the other hand, the eggplant wizard, a famous video game character, has a staff that shoots deadly eggplants. So, Dan, maybe you should stop playing video games and spend more time in the kitchen. You might just learn to love the king of vegetables. That's it for this week's show. If you tuned in too late or want to binge listen every single episode, you can download Milk Street Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. To learn more about Milk Street, please go to 177milkstreet.com. There you can find all of our recipes, take a free online cooking class, or order our latest cookbook, Milk Street Fast and Slow, Instant Pot Cooking at the Speed You Need. You can also find us on Facebook at Christopher Kimball's Milk Street, on Instagram and Twitter at 177milkstreet. We'll be back next week with more food stories, and thanks, as always, for listening.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with WGBH. Executive producer, Melissa Baldino. Senior audio editor, Melissa Allison. Co-executive producer, Annie Sinsabaugh. Associate producer, Jackie Nowak. Production assistant, Sarah Claff. And production help from Debbie Paddock. Senior audio engineer, David Goodman. Additional editing from Vicky Merrick, Sydney Lewis, and Samantha Brown. And audio mixing from Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Theme music by Chewbop Crew. Additional music by George Brendel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.